For those listening to KSBN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with Reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational, grassroots program designed to restore the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. Our toll-free number to call in is 844-320-4299, but I'm going to ask you right now, I know we get lots of callers on this show, I'm going to ask you right now to kind of hold off because we have a special guest and it's a pre-recorded part of this show. I've actually had a great talk, conversation, interview, / dialogue with Professor John R. Vile out of Middle Tennessee University. And I will get into his bio in the next segment, but I just wanted to let you know that we are not going to be doing this for live feedback and for you to call in and you maybe ask the doctor a question. However, we will have him back on, and whether we can do that live or not is different. But if you want to have ask the doctor a question, then by all means, just send me an email. That being said, let me get into my usual diatribe, that many of these shows are linked to each other. And so because I cross-reference conversations and or terms and so forth, you really need to listen to this show to understand little nuances and what something means when I use a word like Platonist. So consequently, to stay abreast, you need to get all the content. So don't feel shy about downloading all of my podcasts. They're free. They're on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. So help yourself. There's a bevy of words and conversations for your taking. Anyway, I'll let that go. The Republican Coffee Club this Friday, the Spokane prosecuting attorney will be there answering your questions. His name is Larry Haskell, if you didn't know. And next week, it will be Representative Matt Shea and Bob McCaslin, who will be basically doing a hot wash or a session review of what they had done, what they've learned, and so forth. So if you want to ask the congressman or legislatures, I should say, a question, then by all means, you may want to attend this. In addition, they will also have Jeremy Hood, who will be speaking on cryptocurrencies, for those of you that like playing with Bitcoin and these other online currencies. If you are heading home, you are heading in the wrong direction. Just remember, if you have a dog, at least your dog will be happy to see you when you get home, if you get home late unannounced. Tonight is the Northwest Grassroots Movie Night, and that means that yours truly will be there doing the presentation. It starts at 5:30, so you have time to turn around and start heading towards Darcy's, and it is in Spokane Valley on Sprague, and it is 10502 East Sprague Avenue. And so if you want to attend, and if you get there early, you'll be able to get a seat, because I have a feeling that it will be probably packed. And so there's not a lot of overflow room. And so I don't know what to say other than those who can't sit down and enjoy dinner and listening to me make you sick, then you can always go into there. There are overflow rooms, but there's just no pipe the sound and the video over there. But the good news is that this will be recorded. It'll be put up on the Northwest Grassroots YouTube page. I will also have a link to it on my Reclaiming the Republic website, as well as we'll probably throw it out on the Reclaiming the Republic YouTube page if you're a subscriber to that as well. So if you miss it, don't feel too bad, but make sure you catch up on it, because this is going to be the first view of the second executive summary of how we can initiate Republic review. So if you do get into the doghouse because you didn't go home unannounced and you have a dog, and at least the dog was happy to see you, well, getting out of that doghouse might be a little easier if you make it out to Sunnyvale Flower Farm in Suncrest and get some of those hand-picked flowers that you can go home and say, look at what I picked for you. And I, you know, I did this for you because I'm so sorry. And I can't guarantee you a fast-track ticket out of the doghouse for doing it. However, I believe that it does, you know, make a good amends, or at least it's on the path of making amends for coming home late because you were learning about the Constitution. I am very optimistic, and I've been working on the unification of some of the conservative groups here in Spokane. I told you this last week. I hope to have more information. We are not meeting for a couple of weeks, but I'm working on a mission statement. So once I have a mission statement out, I will, you know, probably put that up on the website and let you kind of look at, you know, the direction that this unified constitutional group is going to take and our focus on that. I've got probably a lot of little different things that I want to talk about before we get into Dr. Vile. But, you know, the couple of things that just hit me is, you know, I know we're talking about a sanctuary city here and across this nation. I want you to understand that every single one of these politicians that raises their arm to the square and says that they will support, as an oath of office, that they will support the Constitution, and then they say they support a sanctuary city, means that they are defying the Constitution and our rule of law and the contract that the states have delegated to the federal government, and basically delegated that power of immigration. It is their job and responsibility, not the city of Spokane, not the state of Illinois, and so forth. And so when you see these things happening, just take solace in the fact that we are getting organized and we need your help, and that you can get a become a part of this reclaiming the Republic so that we can actually get back on track into the framework and scope of the Constitution. If you look, you know, I've mentioned that Spokane is on a fast track to Detroit. There's other cities that provide great examples of what happens when you get onto the federal dole. The flooding in New Orleans from the few hours of rain, it wasn't even a Katrina that hit them. It was just a few hours of rain, but they got flooding. This is because federal government has basically subsidized a city to exist right on the ocean, a couple of feet below sea level. And it just, the free market would have never allowed that to happen. Had that city been on its own in a free market stance, it would have basically dredged and lifted up that city at least a couple of feet above sea level instead of retaining it the way it is, because it is untenable to have a city like that. And it's only the federal government and the payouts that these levy maintenance companies, because I know for a fact that the government pays millions of dollars each year for maintaining these levies, and that money just goes into the politicians and these companies' pockets because they're not doing anything. And what they could have been doing was they could have been lifting that city up and making that city independent and autonomous of federal handouts. If you haven't read my Clinton corruption on my podcast page, you need to, because this Korea threat and their communicating threats is all stems from Bill Clinton and the Clinton administration selling secrets so that he could get reelected in 1996. So go read that MSNBC testimony, and there's no doubt in my mind you'll come to the same conclusion that the Clinton family is a culture of corruption, that it runs so deep that they'll do anything and everything that they need to do. And we got to keep the Clintons and all of those types of paradigms out of office. And in doing that, we can reclaim the Republic. So if you please stay tuned, we'll be right back after this, and we'll be back with Dr. Vile on the line. Thank you so much. All right. Well, we're back, and we have a very special guest with us. And his name is Dr. John R. Vile, and he is a professor of political science and dean of the University of Honors College at Middle Tennessee University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I hope I got that right.
You got it, yes.
He is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the College of William and Mary and the University of Virginia, studying under Jefferson, I presume.
And absolutely.
And served for 25 years at MTSU's mock trial coach. He is the author and editor of approximately 40 books, some of which he has co-authored or co-edited, and a number of which are in multiple volumes and multiple editions. His primary specialties are the U.S. Constitution and its amendments, the constitutional amending process, the U.S. Constitutional Convention of 1787, and early U.S. politics. And I might actually throw another bone in here for you, Doctor, that you actually cited my material in one of your books. So
absolutely.
So anyway, let me get to the works that you've actually got, because you've got so many, and there's some for our listeners that I think are very, very relevant, because I think lots of people are starting to realize that they need to really understand the Constitution and the way Madison and the framers, Sherman specifically, I believe, was the one that really brought forth the two constituents for the bicameral Congress by doing the Connecticut Compromise. But getting somebody to understand this isn't really, it's not rocket science, it's not difficult, but understanding by reading this, the source documents, and then getting, you know, research documents such as yourself or books and materials and literature really, I think, helps kind of illuminate, because I think you've added a lot of analysis in these. And so the works that I kind of highlighted out of that plethora of material that you've produced, the Constitutional Convention of 1787, and that is a comprehensive encyclopedia of America's founding.
Yes, two volumes.
Right. And a companion to the U.S. Constitution and its amendments, which is now in its sixth edition.
Right, and that's the one, you know, for general readers. I mean, the one on the Constitutional Convention, if, you know, if you're a nerd like I am, you'd enjoy it. But the companion, I sort of try to update with most recent court decisions and, you know, that sort of thing. So that's probably one of the more accessible books.
Right. And let me ask you, going back to that first work, in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, I'm going to presume that you relied heavily on Madison's notes of the convention. What other source material?
Well, biographies, you know, have entries, of course, on each of the 39 and actually the three other people who did not sign the document.
Right.
There's a, you know, a lot of secondary works, but, you know, there's a five-volume set by Curlin and Lerner called The Founder's Constitution.
Uh-huh.
And it has a lot of original, you know, the original documents that you can go through. And then there are all kinds of volumes, as you and I have discussed, on the ratification of the Constitution.
Right, right, right.
You know, which provides some useful insight as well.
Right, but considering the convention itself was kind of close-held and secret, they didn't talk much about it. And as a matter of fact, Madison, being such a person of integrity, felt that, you know, he needed to let Washington know that he was the one that was, you know, violating the oath, and sent him the Federalist Papers and so forth.
Well, I don't think he violated the oath in taking notes. He would have violated the oath if he had released them during the convention or even after it. You know, it's something of an irony or serendipitous part of history, but Madison was actually the last of the individuals at the convention to die, and his notes of the convention were, his wife actually sold the notes to Congress, and I think they were published in about 1840. So in some ways, you know, other than those who attended the convention, we actually know more about what happened at the convention than most people in the early republic did.
Like Andrew Jackson.
That's right.
That's right.
That's exactly right. This Jackson, of course, is not elected until 1828, and so, Yeah, he would not have had access to those notes.
Right, but he did serve as a congressman. I think he was a freshman congressman when Washington was retiring. And I forget which book I read it out of, but somebody made a note that he was the only one that didn't remove his hat when Washington did his march through Congress.
I didn't know that about that about him. I knew he had served as a judge. He's actually from the district where, you know, I live in Middle Tennessee.
Right.
And the Hermitage, which is his home place, is still a remarkable, you know, president's house to visit. When we talk about civic education, one of the things I always tell people is it wasn't until my daughters got married that I realized that apparently other families go to beaches. We always went to historic sites and president's houses.
There you go. Let me move on. So we've also got this other volume or other book. It's self-serving for me because this is the conventional wisdom, the alternate Article 5 mechanism for proposing amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And this is actually where you injected, I think, some of my concepts and cited my material. But this is similar to the reframers, because I think the reframers, as we talked before, was more of some of the individuals and their ideas. And
that's right.
Okay.
The reframers, what I've tried to do is go throughout American history and see what sort of either alternate constitutions or, you know, five or six or more consequential amendments that really would have made a difference. And what's fascinating is actually my first book in 1991 was called Rewriting the Constitution, and the chronological time was a little bit shorter, but I found about 40 proposals. And when I went back several years ago to do this Reframers, I was well over 175 different people. And, you know, they range all the way from, you know, almost sort of a complete libertarian view to, you know, socialism, communism, and whatever. So it almost seems like it's an American thing to do to, you know, sit down with the Constitution and tinker with it or try to figure out how to make it better.
Right. When a lot of the people that I deal with, and my perspective is, I think the Constitution really stands, you know, very well on its own, and it didn't really require a lot of amendments. There are some shortcomings. And I think that some of the things that expired, like the 1808 clause, I think there's nothing wrong with expunging some of those things just so that people kind of understand, you know, in the current Constitution and then having the historical frame, because there are times and points where we've injected a necessity of doing something and then have sunsetted that.
Right.
And so I think it's important that we, you know, can look at a really historical balloon of, you know, all of the things that were in or associated to the Constitution. But what
you
is...
You know, when the Bill of...
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when the Bill of Rights was discussed in the first Congress...
Yes.
There was sort of an interesting debate between Sherman and Madison.
Oh, I absolutely Madison know, yes. Right. He wanted Madison to inject wanted it into to, it, yeah.
Yeah, he wanted to put the clauses in the Constitution where they fit.
Right.
And Sherman said, well, if you do that, it'll make it look like, you know, George Washington's, he didn't use this example, but it would be like George Washington approving women's suffrage, which isn't adopted till 1919. And so Sherman prevailed, and some people think as a consequence the Bill of Rights probably has a greater place than it would if it were simply sort of buried within the document.
I understand that, but I think that many of the amendments in the Bill of Rights would have had to create a new article or section for that on literally a personal immunities and privileges because
well they probably would have put them in Article 1 Section 9 and 10 9 limits Congress and 10 limits the state
and I would have put them into maybe Article 4 as well.
Well, you could put the Ninth and Tenth Amendment there for sure,
right?
limiting the reserve powers.
But either way, let me get back to some of your other documents or books: The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, A Practical Virtue and in Action, and another and the last volume that I've kind of highlighted. the early Republic documents decoded, and this has been republished with an updated volume. We can get more into these, but I wanted to kind of lay these out. And as you can tell, we're coming up on a hard break. So sure. As soon as we come back, we'll kind of close up on your publications. Please stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back after this. Thank you very much. Okay, we're back, and our special guest today is Dr. John R. Vile, and we were just going through his publications, only a few of them. He's written over 40 and has had his hands in many as far as editing and so forth, so he's a prolific writer on the Constitution. And John, if you don't mind my calling you John, I would like to kind of lay out the reason why I selected these is I think there's lots of people, and as you know, there are two camps, and there's three camps, and I've written an article, and I haven't necessarily published it, but you might find some sardonic humor in the title, but it's about the conventionites and the anti-conventionites. And those are the two primary camps. And then I have this group of people that are in the anti-conventionites, where they haven't antied in on either side because they just don't understand what's going on. And there are sure. There are lots of people that are just absolutely frustrated and feel the iron fist of federal tyranny and or the overreaching, or as Madison called, encroachments of the federal government and so forth. And people are going, they shouldn't be able to do these things. And so there is, again, the convention camps that are out there that want to call an Article 5 convention and get the states involved. And that's a completely constitutional process. There's some people who really hate that. And my quip to some of these camps, like the Phyllis Schlafly, the Eagle Forum, Schlafly, and the John Birch Society. Whenever I talk to those folks and they say, we can't be doing this. And I go, well, then why don't you tell Congress to amend the Constitution and take that out? Just remove the state's ability to call for a convention. Well, there you go. Your problem will be solved. And then they kind of look at me and they go, are you kidding me? And I go, well, you can't have it both ways. Either you support the full Constitution as it is, or you have to support, these people. You don't have to support what they're doing, but you have to understand that it is a convention, or the word convention being process. It is a process that is viable within the Constitution for people to get in arms. Now, I don't want to get into that article, but the reason I've highlighted these books is I think these books are great reference points for people that want to understand this debate that we're having in our society now and what, they can do and what they can't do. Of course, my books also do that, but I believe that it's important that you don't myopically live with one author or another, that you try to, diversify information and so forth. So,
you talked about the three groups, and they're sort of the third group. Maybe you may have individuals like me, actually, who absolutely believe it's a constitutional mechanism and that there are appropriate times for its use, who may or may not think that the political winds of the moment are a good time to call a convention. And, just because you favor, it's like the amending, it's like the other amending process, you can favor the process and still be for or against, an amendment for a balanced budget or abortion or, whatever issue one would choose.
Right. Well, I've noticed on both sides, the conventionites and the anti-conventionites, that they take a fragment of information and they basically say, Madison was completely against conventions, which is the anti-conventionite camp. And,
he led one of them or helped lead one of them.
And I argue that the Virginia resolution and their appeal to other states
was basically trying to coalesce not a convention of authoring or an Article 5 type of convention, but my argument is that he wanted the states to step in, admonish the federal government for overreaching and encroaching upon the Bill of Rights, and basically get, you know, them to write a resolution to cease and desist so that we don't have to use, you know, any other means of taking back, you know, what we delegated to you to ensure that that was done that way. And his
Neither Madison nor Jefferson had a lot of luck with that.
No, they didn't.
Mean, they got, you know, and I think you noted this in your little summary. And Madison, I think, Jefferson is, or Mr. Jefferson is what I'm supposed to say, from University of Virginia. Mr. Jefferson, I think, stuck sort of to the end to, you know, states doing this. Madison seems to me to be a little bit more equivocal and seems to have deferred a little bit more to the judiciary resolving these issues. But, you know, clearly the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, they were very important to the, you know, to the Democratic-Republican regime, if you want to call it that, that was, you know, brought about by the election of 1800. And it was a very prominent form of, you know, constitutional interpretation in the early republic.
Right. And Madison actually wrote a separate resolution in 1880 on the Virginia Resolution. It was, I think, Notes on the Virginia Resolution is what it's called. And
it can't be that date. I'm not sure what date it is.
I have the document.
1780?
No, it was 1880.
No, you see it in 1880.
Well, it was Notes on it. And I know the first Virginia resolution was 1798. So this
Well, he does one in 1800. There's a explanation by the Virginia legislature that he either wrote or helped comment on it.
So my bad.
That's probably it.
Was I saying 1880? If I was saying, I meant 1800.
No, that's,
forgive me.
That's clearly what. No, that happened.
Yeah, I sometimes get dyslexic. Anyway, in 1800, he did a follow-on, the Notes on the Virginia Resolution, and the reason I'm bringing it up is he amplified his point of, you know, how he was remorseful that the other states did not step up and recognize their obligation, as he called it in the first resolution, that the states are obligated as the stakeholders of the Constitution to step in and, you know, hold. And as a matter of fact, he said this in the Federalist Papers too, that they needed to erect barriers, they needed to create processes and conventions to be valiant in overseeing the Constitution.
To add to that, though, toward the end of his life, he became increasingly concerned about John C. Calhoun and the doctrine of nullification.
Right.
And so there were words that were actually published after he died, which were, you know, sort of his parting advice to his country that the Union be preserved. And that's why I say I think toward the end he leaned a little bit more toward judicial resolution than he did state resolutions. But, you know, there's certainly nothing wrong with this, you know, with a state calling attention to what it perceives to be an encroachment. But whether you would give, you know, I guess my problem would come with whether you want to give legal significance to that other than as advice to legislators or, you know, advice to those who might, you know, might be thinking of an amendment to curb federal powers within a given area.
Right. Well, anyway, folks, we could go on, and every time I talk to constitutionalists, this could go hours because it gets into all different little micro points in time of Madison's thoughts here, Madison's thoughts there, because he was an evolving man like we all are.
Sure.
And anyway, and I know that one of the things I kind of mentioned I wanted to talk to you about was the lack of education on the Constitution, and that I just find it, you know, abhorrible that we have politicians that don't understand what the Constitution is and that they have these writing bills, or they say, you know, what do you mean? Who cares about the Constitution? We can do whatever we want to do. And
that is shocking.
And when you watch TV and you see the man on the street and they ask basic civic questions, to me it is a huge
you know, embarrassment that our education system is doing what it is. But I believe, and I know you're in the education system, so I'll try to veil this as not as a big insult, but I think this is a shining star of success. If you want to have an electorate and a populace that is completely ignorant of their civics and their government and how to be involved in it. And so that's why people just don't care anymore. And it's why there's so few people that have read the Constitution, so few people that understand or even can speak to it.
Yeah, I think in education, particularly at the high school or college level that does not include civics, is really an inadequate education. And,
right.
You know, part of it is schools are called upon to do, you know, everything from driver education to sex education and, you know, all these new developments in science. And I think sometimes people are so overwhelmed. But ultimately, you know, we're producing citizens,
right.
And they do need to be educated in, you know, how the system works.
Right, right. And as a matter of fact, I've already read the citation from the Cod Fishery Bounties Act of 1792 when Madison kind of schooled, I think his name was Livermore, regarding, you know, using the general welfare, because hey, if the federal government could start using general welfare for things of welfare, then we could take over schools, we could take over healthcare. You know, and I'm paraphrasing, but he really
right.
he the way he frames this, he says, you know, we could unleash a very evil genie that Congress would have full discretion and full judgment over what welfare really is. As we can hear, there's the time for the break coming up, so I apologize for the interruption, Dr. Vile, but we'll be right back, folks, after we hear a few things from our sponsors. So hold tight, we'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and we still have Dr. Vile on the line, and I appreciate your patience in these little interruptions, but let me try to close on this constitutional education, because I think it is one of the biggest problems that we have, because when I keep on hearing people call us a democracy and they don't understand republicanism, I believe that that is a systemic problem within our culture and society. And so do you offer at Middle Tennessee University online courses like Hillsdale College for people to just get a, you know, 101 on the Constitution?
You know, we offer a fair number of online courses, but I don't think we have that specific course. One of the things that I did, and it's a little easier to do it from Murfreesboro, Tennessee than it is from Seattle, Washington, but I took a group of honor students over our spring break, and we went to, I think, five different presidents' houses and historic sites in Williamsburg, Richmond, and then ended up in Washington, D.C. And, you know, we had some classes, obviously, that led into that as well. And, you know, I think we it's very helpful if you can actually go to the sites where they lived, and, you know, particularly on issues that maybe sometimes are covered, you know, the slavery and rights of women and those kind of things. Sometimes it's a lot easier if you can actually go there and sort of see in person.
Right, right, right.
And I've noticed that a lot of the exhibits now, the early presidents, you know, when I was growing up, and I loved it, I mean, you'd go to the president's houses and everything was very laudatory, and it still is for the most part, but they do, you know, almost all of them now have exhibits on slavery and sort of life of the common people during that time. And it's a great way to learn history.
Right, well, I just want to throw it out there as a recommendation, because I believe competition is good, and
sure,
there's not a lot of competition for Hillsdale trying to teach 101 type of Constitution classes. I do believe that they're making good money on it, and it's maybe an opportunity for, you know, Middle Tennessee University.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think that's certainly would be something, you know, certainly something that I'm interested in doing, and
right,
but there might be a market for it.
There you go. Then maybe you could afford guest speakers.
Maybe so.
Anyway, we don't have much more time left, and I know we've talked about the 17th Amendment, and really quick, in the Article 5, there is the Amendment Protection Clause at the very end that talks about you can't pass this amendment and that amendment. And
right,
what is your feeling on that portion of Article 5 that says that the states
cannot lose their suffrage without their consent and the 17th Amendment.
Well, I personally don't think there's a conflict there. It's focusing specifically on the equal representation in the Senate, and of course, even after the 17th Amendment, states retain that. What we sometimes forget, though, is that before the 17th Amendment changed officially from, you know, state legislatures choosing to the people directly choosing the Senate, between that time there were quite a number of states actually that decided on their own that they were going to award the Senate seat to whoever won the popular election. So states already on their own had shown that they had a predilection for doing this. And prior to the 17th Amendment, you had a lot of cases where states just simply deadlocked and were not able to have any representation in the Senate. So if anything, 17th Amendment probably facilitated the equality pledge within Article 5.
Right, but I think it has progressed since the 17th Amendment to a point, because money is now really, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune.
Absolutely.
And money now for a Senate race for the incumbent, they basically have a huge trough of money coming from lobbyists that are out of the states, and the states are literally they're losing their suffrage because their representation is more towards, you know, those lobbyists and those special interest groups that are buying
these
seats.
And, you know, there's a great irony here, because one of the greatest arguments actually for the adoption of the 17th Amendment was that the Senate
because of
had become
that, right.
A millionaires club.
Yeah.
And it that's a problem that it did not correct. And, you know, and actually, of course, being a millionaire should not disqualify one from being in the Senate. But, you know, it certainly suggests that the people might be, you know, more attuned to the interests, as you say, of the one who's, you know, paying the piper.
Yeah, so it's probably well within reason that states should be passing laws and enacting measures to keep external money from being able to influence the elections for their Senate seats. But more importantly, when I look at that protection clause and I look at that suffrage, there were states that did not want to lose their representation. Utah was one, Maryland was another, that actually rejected that, and because of that clause, they should have been able to maintain their process of appointing. I understand that the state still had the voting capability,
right.
But Madison pointed out in the Federalist Papers, and I believe it was Federalist Paper number 10, where he talked about the two constituents, the states and the people. And I don't want to belabor the point, but
sure.
The states really lost.
I think it's Federalist 39, but I could be mistaken. That he talks there about whether it was a federal or a unitary government, and he points out that, you know, in some cases they resembled sort of a national government, and in other cases, including the amending process, more closely.
Yeah. I'm actually speaking of 10, because he uses the words constituents, and he calls them two constituents. That the constituent for the House was the people, and the constituents for the Senate was the states. And so the states have lost that constituency, their representation. They've lost their voice. It's kind of like in Republicanism now, counties have completely lost their representation in state legislatures, because it's all done by the vote of the
people.
They're
not sovereign states, and states sovereign in the same way that states are. That's correct.
Okay. Well, let me get into my views of, you know, and you've read, and I understand that you don't necessarily agree with my executive summary or Republic review of auditing, having the state step in, not to amend it, but to audit it, saying, you know, we've never delegated you these powers. And so if that's something that you don't, you know, so we can cut to the chase, how would you fix or get the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution?
Of course, that's a complicated question. I mean,
you got two minutes.
I mean, it is. I'm not saying that just as an out.
Yeah,
I mean, elections obviously are one mechanism. I think the problem is, I think the American people are divided. I think that, you know, we tend to oppose government actions, except for, you know, if we're on Social Security, you know, Social Security, or if we're a vet for vets care or whatever the different areas are. And I think we have sent, you know, going at least as far back as, as the Washington administration sort of mixed signals as to how strong a national government we want. You know, obviously, you know, generally the Republican Party favors a less, you know, less strong national government, and yet, you know, they have sort of their pet programs as well. So, I don't know. I mean, one solution, of course, is a balanced budget amendment, and I have mixed feelings on that. But I certainly am sympathetic to the idea that, you know, one way to cut the growth of government is to tell them you either cut programs or you raise taxes, and that's something, you know, that this generation of voters can see in a way that they can't see it if you push it on down for three or four generations.
Right, right, right. So I know we really don't have enough time to explore this, so I'm just going to put it out there now. I would love to have you come back, and maybe you can ruminate on a convention and or a process or methodology of how we can, because I don't believe Madison was lying when he said we had an enumerated constitution, that the federal government was limited and defined, those powers delegated to it. And clearly there are no barriers to what the federal government can presume it can do now. And it's come in, and, you know, if you've seen what's happened here in the West, where people have died, they've killed, you know, livestock, they've just taken property from people. And so it's different in different areas, but the West, because there's so much federal property,
right?
And
right.
And to me, that's a violation of the Constitution. But it's so problematic that I'd love to have you back on, because people want solutions. They want to end this tyranny, this perceived tyranny, maybe more on this end. So I want to thank you.
One thing they say is what eternal vigilance is the price of liberty.
There you go.
And
that's true.
That's a good part of it.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming on, and we'll definitely have you back. And thank you so much.
Thank you.